Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, how to make our communities more autism friendly. And having survived 7 armed robberies, I'll be hearing from the bulletproof banker about the rock bottom moment which made him reassess his life. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, this is quite old school, brace yourself, but we've had COVID in the house. I know it's not a call for full lockdown and we can all go about our business now, thank God, but my husband had it. And because I suppose we could test, we did test. I mean, he was feeling lousy, so you don't want to knowingly pass any lousy virus on to anybody else. So he was segregated. We're heading away very soon and I just didn't want a dose for me or the kids. So that was interesting. Definitely missed him around the place and his support. I don't know which I missed more. All of it. No, I genuinely did. We are living with my mum at the moment and she's been away. My son is away with friends and my daughter has been off with her pals. So there we were with the freest house we've had in a long time and it's masks and social distancing. So that was a very interesting week. And my son being away has been an interesting one too. One less person to worry about, to drag off his phone and his Xbox, then worry when he does go out, where is he? Knowing for a week that he's safe and active has been very, very nice for me this week, much as I have missed him. And I have been feeling pretty tired at the moment. There is a lot going on work-wise, house project-wise, getting everything in order to head away for a week. In these times, I often just want to toil, work, trudge around the household chores and then fall into bed. But I've actually been really forcing myself to lean into more wellness practices than normal. So if anyone asks for a sea swim, I'm there and I'm suggesting them. I've been to 2 sauna and cold dip venues. I finally got to go to one I'd recommend, Bective Mill in County Meath. They have this dome set up. So I was there for an Emma West sound bath for an hour and then over to a hot box sauna, which is just set up beside it. And from there you go from really nice large sauna heat to a dip in the river. Absolutely loved it. Great setup there. And there was a group of gorgeous girls having a Zen hen. How much do you love that? I'm not sure. Maybe they'd already had a night out, but maybe they didn't. Either way, it was called a Zen hen. They were there for the sound bath, the sauna, the dip in the river. And then as I was driving off, they were sitting, chatting at the picnic tables all together. And there was a mini veil. Absolutely here for the Zen Hens. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, how autism friendly is your community? And if you're a business owner, have you ever considered looking at ways to be more inclusive for your neurodiverse customers, particularly those with autism? Jill Molyneux is mum to teenager Daniel, who has autism, and she's taken the task of making her local community more autism aware. And it's my hometown too. And Jill and Daniel join me in studio now. Well, you're both very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Jill, how did this come about for you? Obviously, and Daniel, we're going to talk to you a moment about your experience. Obviously, mm-hmm. through Daniel's eyes, you started looking at the community a bit different. But when did you decide to take action?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's been brewing for a while. Last year or the early part of last year, the CDNT, that's the Children's Disability Network team in Baldoyle, ran a kind of group for neurodiverse teenagers. And in parallel, there was a group of parents. And we were doing a course on sort of, you know, that sort of paralleled what they were learning. And after that, we decided, like that was finished sort of April or May, and we decided we wanted to sort of stick together and support each other. So every month we would meet for a cup of coffee and a chat, just, you know, checking in with each other. And I suppose over a period of time, we started to kind of, you know, express concern. You know, certainly for me, I was concerned about Daniel's future and the future of autistic kids in general. There are many, you know, who would sort of feel worried about job security in the future, home security in the future. And I suppose, eventually last February, this February just gone, I just got everybody into my kitchen and I made a little presentation just to talk about really my vision of how we could make our community more autism friendly. And that really includes everything from, you know, hobbies to jobs to, you know, being parts of clubs, using the restaurants, everything in our area in Howth and Sutton. And the rest of the team basically said yes. And they said, yeah, we definitely want to do this. So we'd heard about the Autism Friendly Towns program run by As I Am. So we got in touch with them and that really got us started. So we formed a committee, and of course this is only, you know, a few months ago, but in May we had a meeting down in the Yacht Club in Howth, and we invited other members of the community, and we were actually blown away. More than 60 people turned up, and there was huge interest. So so that's really where it all started. And I suppose, you know, we're trying to make Howth and Sutton autism friendly as a first step, really, to creating a future that is sustainable for our kids beyond us, you know, where they're safe, they have a quality of life that they can continue to have even when we're gone.
Yeah. And I think what I said to you when we were talking about you coming on, this is not just for families or people with somebody in their family who is autistic. This is for all of us to be a more aware and have a more inclusive society. Yeah. So, Daniel, your mum's a bit of a superhero. What do you think of her doing all of this stuff?
Yeah, I think it's a very good. Like, I mean, me myself, like, I don't think I'm really, because I'm quite low support needs, which means like I don't really. I wouldn't need like constant help like all the time. I'd probably like without support, I wouldn't be like good. I wouldn't be doing well, but like I'd be able to like get myself ready in the morning by myself pretty much like usually. Or like, you know, get myself dressed, or like, cuz some people might struggle a lot with like taking care of themselves because of like, I don't know, like sensory issues or something else. But I think like definitely like this could be very helpful, because like when there's like a sort of like community around a family, it's kind of like you can kind of learn like, oh, here's something that can be very useful. Here's some advice, here's some tips. Mm-hmm. And also like just more access to jobs and just like places to go and community and friends.
Yeah. And when you're going around the community, do you face a lot of challenges? Are you made to feel that you're different to everybody else, or is that your normal? How do you feel if you've to get the DART to school, if you've to go to the shop to buy a drink? What's your experience?
I mean, definitely. Like, I mean, it varies how much it like affects me, but like there definitely be issues with noise. Like if there's like loads of cars going by on the street, like sometimes. Or like there's loads of people, that can be kind of a bit like, it can kind of wear on me, like wear me down. Mm. And like, if I'm like in the supermarket or something, sometimes something for me is like light that isn't shaded or dimmed, where it's kind of like glaring into your eyes. Like that is like, if I go into the supermarket, like all the lights will be directly in my eyes, and there'll be loads of people making noise and like music playing. Like that's a big thing with, like a lot of places will have music playing, and that can be very overwhelming. Like, because it's just like extra noise, especially if it's echoey, it can kind of just reverberate around the whole place, and it can be very difficult at times when it's not like made to be purposely accessible.
Yeah, and there's so many things that people wouldn't even be aware of, you know, as a community or as shop owners or business owners. So what sort of changes are you looking to take place, Jill?
Yeah, so I mean, we have what we're looking at doing, it's called Champions Training. And we want businesses and organisations and clubs and public services in the area to sign up to become Autism Champions. So what that is we go in and we will train them about autism. So we'll explain to them what autism actually is, because there is a lot of awareness of autism, but there isn't a deep understanding of what it actually involves and what it is like to be autistic, and the barriers that are there for access to their organisations. So the first step really is, well, going in you know, teaching them a little bit about the barriers and the challenges in their particular organisations, teaching them about autism, and then helping them make modifications so that, you know, it becomes a much more autism-friendly organisation. Now, these adaptations don't actually have to be expensive. They're not really very difficult. They can simply be being nice, being patient, you know, because a lot of autistic people would find their processing of information it's more complex. They're taking in a hell of a lot more information than we are. So therefore, it's kind of exhausting. And it looks like they're processing information much more slowly. So they just need patience. So if, for example, you're in a cafe and the waitress or the waiter asks you what you'd like, and you're autistic, you just need a little more time. So you don't sort of say, oh, would you like, you know, what would you like to drink? And then they don't answer. You wouldn't say, would you like whatever, because then the second question is another piece of information that they have to process before they finish processing the first piece. So patience is a hugely important part, but it's not necessarily intuitive for people, because unless you're aware that autistic people, they receive and they understand and they express information differently to neurotypical people. And unless you're aware of that, you don't know necessarily that you just have to wait and allow them the time to answer the question. So that's one thing, obviously. It's just kindness and patience.
Particularly when there's all the other stuff going on that you mentioned, Daniel, yeah. The noise, the music, yeah. The lights. And do you find that people are impatient? I mean, everybody's in a hurry these days, aren't they?
I think so. For me, like, if I'm like, say if I'm like getting ice cream and there's like a bunch of flavors and I just like don't know what to choose, and there's like a time, it's like there's kind of like a time limit that's implied, and it's very stressful, especially when there's like other noises and other things going on. It's kind of hard to like, it's like my brain doesn't like kind of go like, oh, this is important, this isn't. It's kind of like, it's all like I have to do that like consciously, like myself. I have to like try to ignore like other sensory information going on so I can just focus on this task. And then it'll take me like a good bit longer to like do something like choosing what to get.
Yeah. And how, obviously it's all down to the individual, but how comfortable are you to say, I have autism, can I take a little bit longer? Or would you prefer us to have a more inclusive society where we just wait?
For me, I don't think for me at least, I don't think it's a very like, oh, I need to hide it. But it's also like, I don't know if I want to like broadcast it to everybody, you know?
You are right now.
Yeah.
But in those situations, and I think that's totally fair.
Yeah. And I think if there is just kind of like a more inclusive,
attitude.
Yeah. Mm. There's just like a more inclusive attitude, and it's not like changing behavior if like the behavior's already like inclusive to everybody.
Yeah, I that's the kind of world I certainly want to live in. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions then as well, that people are being rude or, you know, people.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a lot of autistic people won't use eye contact, and that can be, you know, misconstrued as maybe being rude or uninterested. But in fact, you know, the reason they're not using eye contact is because they're focusing much more on what you're saying. You know, so I'm sure you've done this, you know, if you really want to hear something, you close your eyes. And that's what autistic people tend to do. They're closing their eyes. They're averting their gaze from you, because actually Daniel's really good at explaining this. Can you explain why you don't like to have...
It's like... usually, at least for me, like when I'm looking at something, it's like I'm just observing it. I don't have to like interact with it. And but when you're looking at something that's also looking at you, it's like breaking the fourth wall. It's like, because facial expressions can be like so subtle, like you can, something can be, can like feel so subtle, like a change in your facial expression, but it can then look so dramatically like different. So it's like, oh, what if I'm like doing something wrong? What if I'm looking wrong? What if I'm making the wrong facial expression when I'm making eye contact with this person?
Yeah, so you become really self-conscious, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're not really able to focus on what they're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's nearly nicer to avert your gaze to truly listen to somebody.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not rude. It's,
no, it's actually the opposite.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So patience is one thing. Yeah. And what other factors are you hoping will come in?
So then, you know, there's a lot of different sensory, as Daniel has talked about, there's noises and smells and, you know, busyness and what else, Daniel? There's a whole load of different things that bother lights. Mm-hmm. He's talked about lights. So I think different organisations can put in different tools and different accommodations in terms of sensory modification. So they can maybe have, for example, a quiet time, a quiet area. So there are some organisations that'll have, you know, say on Monday morning, a hairdresser might have that time allocated to people with autism, and they'll have the music turned off and the lights maybe dimmed a bit. And like Super Value, for example, they tend to have sensory hours or autism hours. They're not always at the right time, but, you know, at least it's a step in the right direction. So also in restaurants, you can have sensory toolkits. These are sort of PPE for people with sensory difficulties. So a sensory toolkit would include things like sunglasses, ear defenders, fidget toys. So things that help, first of all, block out the sensory overload and also allow them to self-regulate. So those are, that's not an expensive thing to put into your organisation, but it makes a huge difference. Then there's the communication piece. So obviously, we've talked about patience and allowing, allowing the processing of information to be sort of a bit slower and whatever, and just to be kind about it. But then, you know, not everybody communicates in the same way. Some people prefer to use technology. Some people use sign language. You know, there's different ways of communicating, and also on websites as well. If an organization has a website, it's really useful for an autistic person to be able to have a look at that website and see what it's going to look like when they go into that business. So if they go in the shop of, I don't know, Rights of Hoth, for example, they go in and they want to, it's a gift shop. Okay, so if they go in and they know, well, the counter's just on the right-hand side and there's a fish area at the back and then, you know, there's clothes on the left, and they know where things are placed in general, and there's a little coffee shop on the right-hand side. So they kind of have an idea before they go in. So it takes a lot of the guessing out, and if the guessing is sort of removed, there's less information processing for them to do when they step in the door.
Yeah. So, and I think we all want that. I want that when I'm going somewhere. I want to see what a restaurant looks like inside. I want to get an idea of what the place looks like. So this is beneficial for all. And this is what we are really talking about.
Yeah.
And it's sending out a message, isn't it, for a more inclusive society. You're in school at the moment, Daniel. How do you feel about the future then yourself? Because your mom mentioned kind of, you know, thinking about the future and wanting to make sure that, you know, anybody who is neurodiverse has as much chance and opportunity as anybody else.
Yeah, I think like school can be quite like difficult because there's like so many people like in this area. So I think some people definitely find it like the routine of it very like comforting sort of, or yeah, just like a structure that like...
It's predictable.
Yeah, predictable.
Yeah.
But like for me at least, I can find it very like exhausting and quite overwhelming because, you know, you have the lights, the sounds, sometimes the smells as well. You can have like, let's say you're like sanitary or like sanitary toilet smell or
yeah,
or like the smell of like the food from like the
canteen.
Yeah, the canteen.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a sensory overload. And what about the future? What are your hopes for the future?
I don't know. I think like just having more like accommodating, like, for example, like exam environments where like if somebody is like has like a need for like, I need to like go somewhere by myself, that would be like super accessible, super like easy to get.
And at school, he actually, you know, there are accommodations for him. In fact, he's very lucky. The school he's in, they're very accommodating. They allow him to have a different uniform. I mean, it looks similar, but it's more comfortable. And they allow him to go home early, pretty much every day. And then if he's feeling overwhelmed, he can go into the support for learning department and it's nice and, you know, relaxed. So they make a lot of allowances for him. They also do a huge amount of preparation for, you know, the beginning of term, any changes that might happen. Because as Daniel said, a lot of people with autism, they really enjoy the routine of school. But the minute something changes, it throws them off. So the more sensory alerts, that's what we call a sensory alert, an alert to changes in routine that you can give, the better for people with autism.
Yeah, and I hope workplaces of the future will operate in that way as well, so you can thrive there also. Yeah. So how can other communities get involved? Because that's something you're also hoping will happen as I Am.
Absolutely. So As I Am, as I said, has an autism-friendly programme. There are, gosh, I can't remember how many exactly towns and villages around Ireland are signed up, but I think it's in and around 30 now. I think there are actually only two who have actually achieved it yet, because it's a programme. It's a three-year programme where we commit to doing certain things in the community to make them more autism-friendly. We have to sign up a certain number of organisations and businesses and so on. And then once we achieve that, you get the autism friendly status. So only two, I think it's Clonakilty and Maynooth, possibly Blarney actually as well. I can't quite remember exactly which ones, but they're well ahead of the rest of us. And then you've got other ones like Drumcondra, and then you've got Lusk and Skerries, and then there's us, and there's a load of them. I can't remember them all. But, you know, the more we can get on board, the better. You know, we'll be taking trips down to Clonakilty because we know it's an autism-friendly town. And likewise, you know, Howth and Sutton will become much more attractive to autistic people to come and visit if they know it's got the As I Am autism-friendly stamp.
So where can other communities and people find out more?
Yeah, so unfortunately our website isn't ready yet because we're relatively new, but it will be on the As I Am portal. So the As I Am website is www.asiam.ie. So that's As I Am, so it's asiam.ie. And then if anybody wants to get in touch with us, of course, we have an email address. So that's hothsuttonautismcommunity@gmail.com.
Okay, amazing. Well, thank you so much for bringing this to my awareness as somebody from the Howth and Sutton community. And I'm delighted to share it out across the airwaves, because we all want to live in a more inclusive society, because it absolutely benefits everybody. We're all individual, you know, and for people to just be viewed as they are, as I am, is the way we all want to live. So to Daniel and to Jill Molyneux, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, coming up after the break, staying on the topic of autism, we'll hear how Dublin Airport are becoming more inclusive for neurodiverse travellers.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, before the break, we met Jill and Daniel Molyneux, who were talking about the experience of autism in our communities and how our communities can become more inclusive. And I wanted to talk a bit about Dublin Airport, because I received this message from a listener called Louise. She says, "Hi, I just wanted to share my recent experience with travelling abroad for the first time with my wonderful 5.5-year-old non-verbal autistic son, Milo. He has a few issues with transition, and new big places and experiences are difficult at times. So when his teacher made me aware of a service the DAA provides of a walkthrough a few days previous to your flight to give your child awareness and familiarity for the real journey, I jumped at the chance. All I did was reach out to the DAA, and the correspondence and customer service I received was just fantastic. Milo and myself went to the airport 5 days before our first flight and were met by the wonderful Lorraine in Departures, who was our guide for the walkthrough. We had a quick check-in with airport police for identification passes, and off we went through the staff security check-in with hand and bag swaps done. We got to walk through the terminal, and it was amazing to see Milo holding Lorraine's hand through it as it took him a year and a half to hold his teacher's hand, so that honestly shows how special Lorraine is. We got to wait and watch the plane taking off and landing, and there is also an amazing new sensory room open in Terminal 1, which is just a fantastic space to avail of too. This service really gave me great peace of mind for the real journey ahead, and I really recommend it if your little one might need this awareness too. Thank you to the DAA for providing this service. It was priceless for us, and I hope more families can use it for awareness and peace of mind. I'm joined in studio by Sarah Ryan of Dublin Airport Authority. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on.
You're very welcome.
So this is great to hear this real life experience. And I actually saw a video from Louise of Milo, happy on his flight, heading off on their first foreign holiday as a family, much needed, much enjoyed. And making that transition through the airport was really so important. And you're helping lots of families in this way.
Yeah, that's right. We have an extensive programme for accessibility, as we would term it, but that's covering people with both physical or perhaps hidden disabilities, people who need extra time or extra care or extra help to get through the airport. So we're delighted that we recently opened a second sensory room that's in T1, adding to the one that's been in T2 for a number of years. And this is a space that families can book into if they would like to settle or comfort a child or the whole family prior to going on their flights. So we've had positive feedback about that experience, and we're delighted that your listener found the experience worthwhile, and we're aiming to be as helpful as possible to other families.
Because the airport's overwhelming for everybody. There's a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of sensory overload for, you know, neurotypical and neurodiverse, but neurodiverse especially. And with autism, that preparation, that run through is so important. And people might not be aware, they would have thought maybe from a security point of view that you can't move through the airport until you're on your flight. So to know that you can do that, I think it is going to be news to a lot of families.
Great. Well, there is actually something called an important flyer scheme at Dublin Airport. There's information on our website in the accessibility section about this. And essentially, if you have travel booked, you can fill out a form. It does require an official diagnosis of autism or a related condition to be eligible. But if you apply, you get this important flyer status. That's either a lanyard or a wristband. And that signifies to security that you might have a need for extra assistance, and they will help you to move more quickly through the security queue and through the airport. So I'd really encourage any family, and when I say family, it can also be an adult, it's not necessarily a child, so any individual that has an autism diagnosis to look on the Dublin Airport website under accessibility and find out more about that important flyer programme. I think it's probably important to say, of course, there's also perhaps elderly people or people who need wheelchair assistance, or perhaps someone who's had an accident. We never know when we might actually need some assistance. And if there is anyone with a physical impairment that requires extra assistance, there's a comprehensive program for that. Again, you can book in with your airline to notify that you might need special assistance, or through the PRM app. That's Persons with Reduced Mobility. There is an app, and there's also an email, prm@daa.ie. And if you need that assistance, we strongly encourage you to book as soon as you know you'll be travelling, to allow as much time as possible so that we can be set up for your arrival and provide the assistance needed, whether that's moving through security, actually getting to your gate, or any other needs that people may have.
Sounds like Lorraine is a bit of an angel that you've got working in that area. And I understand she's also a parent of somebody with autism. So you're going to meet people along the way that are very understanding in this area and very well trained.
Absolutely. Lorraine is so passionate about helping families, and she describes her role as giving a voice to people who may have extra needs. And she advocates on their behalf, and she takes direct feedback from them if there are improvements that we can make. She shares that with the business, and she really is a fierce advocate, and we're lucky to have her working with us.
Because something I heard before the break from Jill and Daniel Molyneux talking about how businesses can become more autism friendly, lighting, noise, music, was all part of it. I mean, it seems like it would be almost impossible to dim Dublin Airport. I'm sure people coming in on those early morning shifts need those bright lights to help fuel them through a day working at a duty-free counter. But are there ways in which the airport can become more autism-friendly in that sense?
So I think we're always open to feedback and we're always looking to evolve the service that we are offering. There's a lot in place currently, also in terms of just finding your way through the airport. We think about signage. We think about the journey from the perspective of someone who may have special or hidden needs. Lorraine actually shared with me a story that she had worked with a young man in his 20s who had become paraplegic as a result of an accident. And he wanted to go on holidays with his friends. And he came and experienced what that would be like in the airport. And he had some important learnings. He had a modified wheelchair, which because of this tour was realised may not suit all aircraft types. And he was able to understand which airline would be best for him. And he did go on that holiday with his friends. So there's many aspects of challenge for people with special needs. And we try to be as helpful as possible and definitely want to hear feedback from those passengers.
Yeah, and I think that's what's important. Speak out and give that feedback, because that's where the learning comes and that's where the change comes from. Where can people find out more? What area of the website?
So Dublin Airport, it's there in the main tabs on top, accessibility. There's also videos of what the journey through the airport looks like. There's information about parking, about signage, about the important flyer scheme. So there really is a lot of information there and encourage people to look at that.
Well, that is great news. And thank you so much for coming on. Sarah Ryan there from the DAA. Right, coming up after the break, having survived 7 armed robberies, I'll be hearing from the bulletproof banker about the
alive and kicking
which made him
on News Talk.
Life. You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, during a 40-year corporate career, Brian Kennedy built a reputation as a trusted leader. Now, as a seasoned motivational speaker, mental health and wellness coach, he empowers clients to surpass their limitations. He's just published his first book, The Bulletproof Banker, and he joins me in studio now. Well, Brian, you are very welcome.
Thanks for having me, Claire.
It's hard to know where to start because there's so much in the book and so much in your story, but I think we'll start with the title itself. It's called The Bulletproof Banker because one of the parts of your life is that working in the banking sector, you were a part of 7 armed robberies. You survived 7 armed robberies. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, in fact, I start the book with one of those armed robberies and where the guy slams my head into the safe and is demanding that I open it and has his forearm on the back of my neck. And he puts a double barrel shotgun under, you know, my neck and tells me to open the safe. And my thought at that stage was not for my family. It wasn't for my life. It was, if I can stay calm here, I'm a pretty good prospect for promotion in this organisation.
Wow.
And that's where my mindset was. And when you go back to the very beginning where my early educators, and I'm of an age where, you know, education is different now, thank God. My early educators would have told us we were not going to be any good. They put us at the top of the class when we got the questions wrong. They shamed us in front of our peers. They taught us fear, shame and guilt. They put us in the corner. And when we got emotional, they'd poke us and say, you know, what are you crying for? Are you a girl? What are you going to do when you're a man? You have to look after a family. And what that did to me, I can only talk for myself personally, but maybe many people of my generation, was that we felt that we had to have all the answers. Asking for help, not knowing the answer, was a sign of vulnerability. And I decided very early on in my life that I would not show vulnerability. And I brought that into my football career that got me a trial in the UK in England. And I brought it through my corporate career, which I got promoted in every single organisation that I worked for. And getting through 7 armed robberies was a prime example of I'm bulletproof. Nothing can affect me. I am going to chase this corporate dream. I'm going to chase this success. But actually, if you take a moment to think about it, I had no idea what that success looked like. None whatsoever. And, you know, as I sit here today before you, I can tell you that I'm probably the luckiest man in the world, and that I met my wife when she was 16 and I was 18, and we're 39 years married next month. And if she's listening, I love you, sweetie. You know, we're 46 years together, and I'm truly blessed. But I left Martina to do everything at home with our kids, to buy our house that we live in now, because I was in my head chasing a corporate dream. And it takes a very strong woman to support a person who's in their head like that, who believes that it has to be them that looks after the family. It has to be them that is successful. But actually, you do not know what success looks like. So the book was written to help many people, should I say, particularly men, you know, that was in my head, who struggle with the mindset that I had, who struggle in work to say no, to set boundaries, and dare I say, to believe in themselves, because we're living our lives at 100 miles an hour, that, you know, Monday becomes Friday and January is suddenly October, and we sit back one day and we wonder what's happened. So all of that culminated for me where I was working 84 hours a week, managing a department in a bank, and one very tiny little experience during that day put me over the edge, and I suffered mental exhaustion.
And when you talk about that particular robbery at the start of the book, I was really surprised, because usually these are the things we see on TV, you know, in a drama, in a film, and to know that it is real and that it happens, you never really think about what happens afterwards. And after the balaclava clad robber left with the contents of the safe, the police arrived, you helped them with their investigation, and then it was back to work.
Absolutely.
That's the bit that really got me. And you were greeting customers and leading your team after something hugely traumatic. You'd had a gun to your life had been threatened and endangered. And it was just like back on it, like a flick of a switch.
7 armed robberies, all exactly the same. Serve customers after, depending on the time of day that the robbery happened. A gun to my head, a knife to my throat, a syringe pointed at me back in the day. The guards would come. Is everybody okay? My regional management would come out, and the first question they would ask would, how much was taken? So I try to, the message that I'm trying to get across in the book as well is one of leadership, which is, how do you react to the people that you're leading? Do you understand the impact that you can have on their lives, their mental health, and the way in which you're speaking to them, leading them? Are you being truthful? Are you building trust? And unfortunately, I've worked in very toxic environments where it probably wasn't safe to speak up, even though you were encouraged to speak up. Okay. And I bottled every single bit of that pressure and stress and, you know, errors in my world, in what I did for a living, was not acceptable. You can hear people talk about, oh, would you have to make an error and you learn from it? Yes, of course you do. But I had a bunch of stakeholders behind me that would berate me over the mistakes that my teams could make, because they had a financial impact on the person whose accounts we were dealing with. So therefore, they did not accept in any shape or form error. And I had to try to mind my people. And that was a struggle at times, because you can't be in my head, managing the stress, catastrophizing about the future all the time, and not bark at the people that you love or the people that you lead in an organisation.
Yeah, it's going to come at some cost. There's going to be a cost somewhere.
Absolutely.
So you touched on the 84 hours a week and that leading to complete burnout. Tell us about that, that rock bottom moment.
So it was a very simple thing that happened in work that put me over the edge. And I knew at that point I had to get out of the office. And I got into my car and I drove home. I do not remember driving home. I remember pulling up outside the house and walking into the house. And Martina looked at me and knew straight away something wasn't right. Now, she has been used to me working very long hours in different organisations. But she knew straight away, women's intuition, whatever you might be. And she said, "Are you okay? What's wrong?" And she tells me that there was just this grey shadow over my face. I just did not look like me. And I said to her, "I don't think I can do this anymore. I don't think I can do this anymore." And I don't know whether she knew what I was talking about, whether it was a marriage, and it wasn't that, because I'm blessed and we're extremely happy, but it was just work. And she sat me on the couch and we had a bit of a chat. I don't know what we were talking about. I probably talked gibberish. I slept for 2 hours on the couch. And she brought me to the doctor the next day. And the doctor said, "Brian, you are mentally exhausted. Your brain needs to stop. You need to get away from a phone, a computer. You need just nothing. Nothing." So he signed me off work for 3 weeks. And that was the first time, I think, ever I'd been sick in a career. And the following Monday, as I explain in the book, my kids are gone to school and my wife has gone to work and I'm sitting on the couch. And I'm watching Jeremy Kyle on the telly, and what a show. And I just felt this wave of emotion coming, and I fought it. You do not show emotion. I had this suit of armour. I'm on my own. And I fought it, and it was so deep, and eventually it just burst through, and I cried like a baby, and the snot ran out my nose, and I didn't know what was happening. I never cried like that before. And at one point, I could see myself from the ceiling, looking down at myself. And I heard this voice call me. And I used to hear that voice when I was a kid, because I'm a twin, and my twin died at 3 months. And I promised that I would live our life for both of us. And I had forgotten that promise. At that moment, I realised I was so much in my head, I had forgotten that. And I stood up, I looked at myself in a mirror. I did not recognise who I saw. And I get emotional when I think about it. But I thought I was losing everything. I thought I was rock bottom. And this voice said, "Go out into the garden, make yourself a cup of tea, go out into the garden." And I did, and I sat there. And this robin came and sat beside me in the garden. I don't know whether you read that story in the book. And this robin just sat there and looked at me, nodding his head. And he went from the table to the top of the chair. And I suddenly found myself calming. And I, you know, I just felt my body calm, and I was intrigued by this little robin. And I have a great faith. My mother brought me up to have a great faith, and I know there's a difference between religion and spirituality, but this was a deeply spiritual moment. And I thought I would go and get a biscuit for this little bird. And then the other thought was, "No, don't, because you'll frighten him away." And I wanted to stay in that moment, because that was the first time ever I'd been in the present moment, what they call the present moment. It was just me and the bird. Didn't care about the past, wasn't catastrophizing about the future. It was just me and this little bird. So I just had this thought that if I can have that compassion for that little bird and not frighten him, could I not show a bit of that to myself? Not be so hard on myself. And to just look around what I was grateful for, you know, and understand what was the purpose of my life and what had it led up to now. And I you know, I thought of Martina, my kids, and, you know, how happy we were. And I just said to myself, well, what else is there? But that's success. Look at the house I have. You know, things that I was striving for. I had a good job, a good pay, beautiful house that Martina, by the way, had bought, had put an offer on before I'd even seen it because I was too blinking busy in my head. And it was just a whole change of reality, values. And I vowed that, you know, when I went back to work, I would no longer look for promotion, that I was very happy. I would mentor people. I would bring them on. I would try to help them not to make the mistakes that I had, but like bearing in mind that everything that has gone through my life has made me the nice guy that you see today and wanting to help people. So I wouldn't necessarily change anything. But if I'm honest, you know, work was chaos in my head, catastrophizing every day, not enjoyable. School was the same. But since I had that breakdown and once I had counselling and, you know, the counsellor said to me one day, Brian, you know, sometimes like the phoenix, you have to burn in the flames to come back. And I felt, that's what I've done. And, you know, I named my inner critic Cedric. And I listen to Cedric when he tells me I'm not good enough. And then I tell him to
clear off,
bug off. but I listen to him. I don't fight him. Whereas I probably would have had this inner battle all the time. And in the book, I write about a really good friend that I made during my recovery called Marcus. And that was Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor who died, believe it or not, on the 17th of March, I think, AD 180, St. Patrick's Day. How amazing is that for an Irish guy to make a pal? Because his meditations, when I read his meditations, you know, about our thoughts and how they affect the way we live, just made me really think about life. And Tom Huddleston's quote that I have in the book where he says, we all have two lives and the second one starts when we realise we only have one, is a game changer. So can I just get people who, you know, obviously please buy the book and read the book, but if you can identify yourself in me, can I ask you please just to slow down? Look at what you're grateful for. Look at what you've got. And try and let's take it to the basic. What is the basic of what you want in this life? And what is your ceiling? Because when you get to the ceiling, now you can enjoy life. But if you're like me and you are constantly chasing something that you didn't even know what it was, you just knew you had to be successful because my early educators told us we were not going to be, you know, and that's a mindset. And I'm rabbiting on a bit now, haven't I? But, you know,
no, you've poured your heart and soul here. I mean, you've made me emotional at times as well. And I love that you've rounded it off like that with advice for people to slow down, because you don't necessarily have to hit rock bottom or have that big implosion in your life to give yourself the gift of time. Yeah. You gave yourself initially that 3 weeks off work and yeah, everything changed, but really it changed in that powerful moment where you sat and had a cup of tea in the garden. And I yeah, think we can all have a cup of tea in the garden and check in and go, am I okay? Is everything okay? What's working? What's not working? And you're right. I love what you said about the ceiling, because if we just keep travelling up in the lift, we're not getting off at any floor. How are we enjoying the building? It's a brilliant book, packed full of personal story insight. I mean, you've got a flavour of Brian right here, and then all of the tips that he has learned along the way and really practical advice. It is called The Bulletproof Banker. Brian Kennedy, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Right, that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.